And welcome to the Friedberg first quarter conference call. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Al Friedberg. Al, good morning.
Good morning, David. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a quick, a lot to cover today, and just some quick housekeeping. We try and keep the call to about 45 minutes. If you have any questions, you're welcome to email them to me during the call. My email address is drothberg@niagaracapital.ca, or you can text me questions if you like. My number is 416-993-4160, 416-993-4160, and I'll do my best to put your questions to Al. I'm going to act as I normally do, as a bit of an interlocutor. We've got, we'll ask Al for his views about where we stand where the economy generally stands and how he's positioned. And then we've got a bunch of questions that have been sent to us already, and we'll respond to those and do the best that we can to answer yours if you have any. Okay, Al, let's get right to it. Let's talk to begin with. Let's get settled. Where are we in the world? We got, as I said in a reminder that I sent out to people last night, we live in a kind of delicate balance where on one hand there are people who fear that because of declining PMIs, that declining earnings and declining stock prices will fall as night follows day. There are those who say now that the trade deal with China, the reflation of China, growing a surprisingly uptick in European activity, and the Fed having moved from being to a more dovish stance means that the expansion is really due for another leg, and recession is a long, long way out. The balance between these two is kind of disquieting in the sense that there's been an astounding lack of volatility. It's as though there's a quiet before the storm. We don't know whether the storm is to the upside or the downside. How do you live in this world? How do you live?
How do you live? You drink Coca-Cola.
And
then you have lots of friends. Listen, look, you know, we are going through a slowdown. There's no question about it. And there's a slowdown all over the world. But it does not look that there is no stress, no special stress that can trigger this thing and to let it go into a worldwide recession. Normally, recessions have begun after, let's say, tight money periods, where or after periods in which real incomes have suffered very severely, let's say a large increase in the price of oil or commodities in general, or inflation in general that has eaten into purchasing power. We have none of those happening. So I don't think that we are anywhere near a recession at the moment. I think that we are in a bit of a pause. And I would say that the horizon, the economic horizon for the next 6 months, a year anyway, look pretty good. I don't see any real danger. The danger is not turning into recession. The danger is when the recession does come about, when it does, and at some point it will, when it does, because we have created so much debt along the way, because it's built on so much credit, the recession will be fairly pronounced. I mean, it could be a pretty horrible. So the risk is not that we're turning down and we're going down now, unless some catalyst takes place that is very unusual. But the risk is when it does, it's going to be difficult to contain it, and it's going to have create a lot of damage. So for now, I think that we are we feel that some of the economies will recover faster than others. The U.S. seems now to be turning back and regaining some speed on the upside, and probably hit around 2% GDP growth rate. We have almost the best combination possible for a market, because we have a Fed that is not too interested in gaining back normalcy when it comes to rates. I think that they're happy with the 2%, they may be happy with 2.5%, but they're not going a lot higher than that. We have very little inflation, extremely low inflation, given that we have an unemployment rate of 3.8%, even labor inflation is very, very, very modest. So commodity prices have not been very strong. In fact, they've been very stable, other than oil that has climbed a little bit. Most commodities have been very stable. So we don't have any signs of inflation accelerating. And so that's a good background. That's generally a very good background for the economy. Important
well,
will be
think,
earnings. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead. No, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm just saying that earnings will play a bigger and bigger role. And we have seen already some shrinkage in corporate profits. We had a tremendously long, a very long period of rising profit margins. And that's come to an end. I think it peaked about a year ago and now starting to come down a little bit. But on the whole, stock prices, given where interest rates are today, stock prices are very attractive. That is given, even though historically the P/E ratios are high, but given where interest rates are today, especially real interest rates, where they are today, stock prices remain almost the only game in town.
And yet, you are not screaming to buy stocks. Your portfolio is a mixture of longs and shorts. So while it doesn't reflect an anxiety about recession, neither is it an all-in bet on the S&P going to 3,500.
Right, right. I think that's a fair observation. You know, even though I'm generally comfortable with the outlook, I really want to emphasize only very special situations. I believe that if you can get two or three special situations to do what you think they will do, I think you can do a lot better than just following the market up, just following the S&P up. So we are concentrating on very, very special situations. We think that these will perform very well. They will, and I don't think there's a need for us to look widely for anything else. I am concerned a little bit about this shrinkage in profit margins, which means that it may be difficult to find very attractive industries. It is difficult to find very, very, very attractive industries. One may find individual stocks, but our strength is not in finding individual stocks. So I rather concentrate on a few industries that I think I understand and that I believe have exceptional potential. And the same is true on the short side. There's certain areas that are certainly overpriced and that are about to enter into very difficult moments, like the Australian banks, which we can talk about.
Well, let's start with an old friend, which are our American home builders. You've been in the quarterly report that we sent out last week. You talked about reducing the position. There are a lot of people who've sent questions regarding the magnitude of the decision. What does it mean? Does it represent a fundamental change? This morning, just before the call, you and I were speaking, and you're saying now that you're massaging that position larger. Can you speak a little bit about this?
Yeah, I made a decision about something like 6-7 weeks ago to reduce a little bit of the position because we were watching very closely the spring season. And we wanted to get assurance that at least now the market was going to do what we expected it to do. And the spring season started very slowly. It was very disappointing, especially disappointing because mortgage rates had come down about 90 basis points. From where they were late last year. So I was kind of anxious and watched a very halting recovery, which was not good enough. it was not good enough for us to maintain a large position, because then we would probably do no better than the market. And I was looking for something that can do better than the market. So I reduced the position. I reduced the position, but with an eye of towards increasing it if and when we see an improvement in line with what we thought should happen. Actually, we are beginning to see that improvement. For example, it took a little bit of time for the drop in mortgage rates to kick an increase in uptake in mortgages, and we've seen that in the past few weeks, where now suddenly we have purchase mortgages increase something like 10 to 12% year over year. That's a sharp increase, and it just happened now, the last couple of weeks. It may be that it takes time until people can get their papers in order, and they can get their banking arrangements in order, and so it takes time for it to show. But we are seeing it now. We're also beginning to see a little bit more activity in the different communities across the country, in sales. So that's happening. And what's happening in addition to that is that home builder prices, home builder stocks, are very, very, very slowly starting to outperform the market itself. This to us was very important as a technical signal. We wanted to make sure that we were in an industry that can do better, and that it was moving sideways for a while. It wasn't interesting. It wasn't something that you know, we could do just as well being long the S&P, like you talked about it before. But in the last 10 days, I would say the market, the home builders market, has shown strength, relative strength. That relative strength was important to us. And so we have again started to rebuild the position. We think that maybe now is the moment. Now is the right time. Mortgage rates remain cheap, relatively cheap. Affordability ratios are good. They're not as fantastic as they were in 2004 or 2005, but they're good. The economy is doing well. Unemployment is down, and it looks like it's going to be even lower soon. So even real median incomes have increased substantially in the past 2 years from what we read. So
household formation is increasing.
Household formation is increasing, correct. So all these things are now factoring in into what looks to me like potentially a very strong upside move, relative to the market. So I'm not counting on the markets to do well necessarily. I'm counting on this group to outperform the market. So we did keep a substantial position, but we are now rebuilding it. And at some point it will, I believe that even interesting way of playing it is, and we're thinking about doing that in a more pronounced way, is to buy the home builders against a sale or a hedge sale of stock indices. So that what we are in effect doing is we're saying home builders will outperform the market, outperform the economy. And that may be a less risky way to play the theme. So that's one of the things that we're doing now. And I remain very bullish in the long-term potential of this market, because we've said before, there is a latent demand there, a very strong latent demand, and there's been very little building for the past 10 years.
So if the fundamental conditions of home builders could be thought of as the climate and the current waves of data that we read about mortgage apps and home prices are the weather, where do you want home builders to stand in the portfolio? You have a fairly concentrated portfolio, as you indicate in your quarterly letter. You basically have four positions. How large of a position do you want this to represent, given what you see today, given the weather forecast that you see today and the climate as you perceive it, and we won't get into climate change or anything of that sort. We're just talking now about business.
Right. I would ideally my target would be to and again I'm, let's speak relative. That was if especially if we do it on a hedge basis. If we do all of it on a hedge basis, some of it will, some of it won't. I'd say that the ideal home builder's exposure would be somewhere in the area between 40 and 50% of the portfolio. That's the ideal.
That's to say that you know, that a 1% move up would represent a 50 basis points change to the to the NAV of the fund, of the global macro fund, of the asset allocation fund. It would be smaller.
And the asset allocation would be a little bit smaller. It would probably be somewhere in the area of 15, maybe 18%.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Let's move on to Australia, which is not an unrelated set of conditions. In that your short position in banks is dependent upon property values in Australia, and a lot's happened since the last quarterly report. The property values there have declined a lot, and so much, in fact, that the Central Bank of Australia has had to come out and attest to the strength of the banking system there. It's well capitalized, they claim, and it can sustain a 30% fall in home prices. So.
Right.
Does this mean that, like, how do you position yourself with that? Is this an indication of fear on the part of the central bank, or is this, are they just doing their duty? Does this tell you that you're more right than you were? How do you feel about this?
Well, yeah, I think that this is the first acknowledgement of the central bank that this situation is a little more serious than they thought. Prices have, on the average, have gone down something like 10 to 12% on the average. The bigger cities, Melbourne and Sydney, where the excesses were greatest, have come down a little bit more than that, and they're still coming down. Now, the market remains generally I won't say optimistic, but the market is unconcerned, and so are the Reserve Bank officials, unconcerned. And the reason is that, number one, they claim that the rise in prices was spectacular, which it was, and people are sitting on fairly large profits. And so a drop of 15 or 20% or even, I don't know, maybe they think 30% won't affect consumer sentiment that much because they're sitting on very large profits. So it's like giving back some of your profits. Number two, they think that the banks are very well capitalized. And so they can resist a decline. And they've said that they're capitalized well enough to resist a 30% drop in prices. Now, these kind of stress tests are very difficult to make. They're very difficult to make because we don't know what the loop, the feedback is in this thing. If house prices come down 30%, what is the impact on consumer sentiment? And we don't have any history for that. It's got to be very large. The other thing is that even if people are sitting on very large profits, the majority of people, when they're sitting on very large profits, tend to use it. They either borrow on the extra profit. They refinance, for example, their mortgages, and they take out money, or they go on consumer credit and they borrow more money and they buy more things because they feel richer. So you can't say that there is a profit margin there that will allow them to ride the decline easily. Chances are that they are probably borrowed up to the top. And when prices start coming down and they have to do something, they have to sell a home and they can't sell it, or they sell it with a 20 or 25% decline from the highs, chances are that they are starting to eat heavily into their net worth. So I'm not sure what the suppositions are when you make the stress test. I'm not privy to the way they do it. And the second thing is, even if the bank, when the central bank says that the banks are in good shape, that they can withstand a 30% drop in house prices, I don't know what other factors. Now, with what other hits to their capital will come related to the drop in house prices? Maybe right. Consumer credit will go into, right? Consumer credit can go into a downward spiral. But it's more than that. It's, they don't tell us what will happen with banks and their dividend provisions. Banks right now, the major banks, the ones that we are short, the major banks in Australia, are paying out between 80 and 90% of their earnings in dividends. So even if they could withstand, and even if their solvency is not in question, but their dividends are in question, there's no question about that. And already we've seen this past week, one smaller bank cut dividend by a few cents, but that seems to be like, to me, that's the beginning. So if and when the time comes and the bank starts cutting dividends, and that's the only reason why they're holding here where they are, I think you're going to see a very quick repricing of these banks, and they'll trade. I mean, today they're trading at, today they're yielding anywhere between 5 and 8%. The dividend yields are enormous. And in a country where the central bank rate is 1.5% and where 10 years, the 10-year treasury is trading under 2%, 5 to 8% dividend yields are very attractive. So I would think that a lot of retail and institutional investment sits with banks and props up bank shares. When dividends become more, when dividends become more vulnerable and when dividends start getting cut, you're going to see a very large drop in their prices. So we are betting that this is coming. We just have to be a little bit patient. We think that there's going to be drops of anywhere between 30 and 75% in the price in the shares of Australia, of the big Australian banks.
We're going to go to talk about China in just a second, but before we do, how anxious are you about the China reflation on Australian bank shares? As we know, a good deal of the Australian economy and a growing share of the Australian economy is a function of strength in China. If China manages to pull it off, are you anxious about this position in the Australian banks?
Yeah, so I would qualify that pulling it off, which is a, it's an interesting expression, what that means. Does pulling off mean that we're now turning and going back to high rates of growth for the next 5 years? Or does pulling off means that we just saved ourselves from a severe recession? We're just bouncing a little bit, but we did it at the expense of more debt, more credit, more vulnerability, and then we have another problem a year from now. I think that's the latter. I think China is now in the latter phase, which is they are now losing altitude. From time to time, they're able to pull things together and do more and spend more and increase credit and then stop the plane from going any further down. But there is no question in my mind that China is no longer the economic powerhouse that it was. It's a powerhouse because it's huge, but in terms of growth, it's no longer the power that it was. And I think that we are just going to be losing altitude. It will be, we'll be going down to 3% growth, and like almost everybody else, or like what happened to Japan, and then 2% growth, and very vulnerable, because we have done what we have done in the past 20 years is increase debt at an exponential rate. So I don't think that that will have a major impact on Australia. It has some impact on commodity prices. These kind of recoveries, these kind of bounces have an effect on commodity prices. You see that already, for instance, in the price of iron ore. Other commodity prices are steady. They haven't fallen despite the worldwide slowdown. But we haven't seen any big increases either. So I don't think that China is any more a positive force for Australia. I believe that other than iron ore, the play is spent.
Well, what you're saying has enormous implications for a longer-term view of growth and securities prices and equity prices.
In China,
Yeah. Well, and
or
globally.
you mean outside globally?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that what happens in China's equity market will have an impact on global equity markets. I'm not sure. It's still very closed, right? It's still a very closed circuit. The capital account is closed to some extent. The Bank of China doesn't allow money to go out easily. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese who want to take money out can't do it anymore, and they used to do
Now
it freely. So,
you still have a bearish bet on the yuan, if I'm not mistaken. This is a long bet. It's in the form of options. It's not become significant, but you mentioned in the newsletter a couple of people have taken note of it. Can you talk about it a bit?
It wasn't a good trade. I mean, obviously, it wasn't a good trade. I mean, I expected that China would opt for the devaluation route to get out of the slowdown. Instead, what they did is they managed to close, they managed to gum to gum up the border so that they don't have to worry about outflows, and they reflated internally the domestic credit and other kinds of fiscal measures that they took. So they propped up the economy internally. They closed the borders so money wouldn't come out. So actually, the currency did not suffer. There may have been some kind of also there may have been some thinking, official thinking, number one, that they can do a better deal with the U.S. if they allow the
Yeah.
currency to remain firm, which is probably true. The U.S. has been pressing them not to manipulate. Manipulate means not to devalue. And also there is the feeling that the Chinese probably want to get the Chinese currency to be a competitor to the U.S. dollar, at least in Southeast Asia. I think they want to become sort of a bit of a reserve currency. And the steadier they are, the better the chances of the yuan being accepted as a reserve currency, at least in Southeast Asia or throughout Asia. So, we bought these options. We lost, I would say that we probably lost somewhere between 2 and 2.5% of the portfolio having bought these put options. They're worth very little. They still have maybe 6 months to go. I don't think it's worth liquidating them for just too little involved. But we still have the possibility that if there is a breakdown in the negotiations, and if there is some unforeseen breakdown in the talks, that this can still be worth some money. But as it is now, it's been a failed trade. And fortunately, it was done mostly via options, so it wasn't very expensive.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the negotiations go, it all sounds very, very good, but evidently there's no referee in place to govern whatever arrangement that they make. It's all up to the two sides to be able to decide if anyone broke breaks any of the rules. So yeah, without an external referee and anyone saying no, you committed a bad, it could break down in a heartbeat. While it
Right, right,
sounds
right, right, right.
it could
Right.
break down in a
That is
heartbeat.
probably the biggest problem. The biggest problem is how to monitor and how to enforce any violations of the agreement. And that's going to be a problem. It's very difficult to do that.
Now, in keeping with the with China looking to have the yuan, the renminbi, a reserve currency, you have a position in gold that you have for many, many reasons. But one of them is that you've argued for a long time now that China would be a buyer of gold to in keeping with that theme. In recent months, there have been announcements that in recent months China's been buying 10 tons of gold monthly, and your feeling is that this may be the beginning of something that's significantly larger. The gold has not broken out above 1365, which I think is technically the breakout level, but neither has it declined. It's building a very steady base at around the 1300 level. What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, I think China is, as you say, I think China is probably the key to this market. There's two reasons why China may want to increase its gold reserves, or the gold ratio of its reserves. The first reason is that that they are economically, maybe politically vulnerable, in that they that maybe two-thirds of their reserves, they have $3 trillion of reserves, so it's the largest reserves in the world, $3 trillion. Out of that, about two-thirds is in U.S. Treasuries. So it's not a very good investment for them. I mean, it's been good because it's steady and it's done better than some of the other foreign currencies and it's paid some interest. But it's not good. It makes them vulnerable. When the U.S. is your rival, your economic rival, your political rival, your military rival, even though they're not fighting a war, but there is a posture of rivalry between the two. I don't think it's smart to have two-thirds of your reserves in the credit of your rival, right? So it would make sense for them to lower that proportion of treasuries. The problem is that they don't have other places to put their money. There are very few markets in the world as liquid. There are none as liquid and as large as the U.S. Treasury market. So you have nowhere to go, and your choice is to buy a little bit of Japan and buy a little bit of European bonds. They yield even less. So I think that they have it's a hard choice for them. But I would think that to own more gold, especially when the major economies of the world, as on the average, I'm not saying individually, because Canada, for example, has no gold. But the major currency, if you take the average, it's got to be around 40% gold content to the international reserves. And China is got about 2.4 or 2.5 or 2.6, something of that sort, 2.5% in reserves, gold reserves. So it's very small, and my thinking is that they would want to, at some point, increase that proportion from where it is today to at least something like 20-25%. That would be one reason. And the other reason would be that perhaps that if you want to show that your currency is a strong currency, psychologically, and this is something that they may want to do, and that they're trying to do maybe, is, as we said before, is you want to show that you have gold backing. Gold backing has been traditionally, for the last thousands of years, a sign of strength. So for the two reasons, I think that the Chinese are likely to increase at some point their gold reserves, and to do that is difficult for them because they have a lot of money. So just to give you a few numbers, I was playing with a few numbers the other day, and that is they are buying at the moment, for at least the last 5 months, they're buying around $450 million of gold a month. That's about their buying rate, 10 tons. In 1 year, that's about $5 billion. So in 1 year, they would end up buying $5 billion worth of gold. If the target, this presumed target, I'm inventing this, but if the target were 25%, the 25% of reserves of their international reserves could be invested in gold, then you're talking about buying owning $750 billion worth of gold compared to the $5 billion a year that they're buying now. So mm-hmm. The buying rate, if you divide that over, say, a reasonable period of 5 years, we want to get to that target, the 25% target over 5 years, you're talking about buying 30 times more gold than you're buying now. So instead of buying 11 tons, they would buy, or 10 tons, they'd be buying 300 tons a month. Now, that's very hard to do without moving the price. So
I'm calling my broker.
That...
I'm calling my broker. I want to put on a trade.
You're right. Well, but my sense is that they're probably going to test the market, and that's what they're doing now. They're buying 10 million tons. If the market takes it well, the market seems to have taken well, meaning the market hasn't run away from them, maybe we'll see them move up to 20 tons, 15 or 20 tons. If we see that, I think that then we'll know that that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to increase significantly the gold reserve. By the way, something very interesting. So far, you can't really make too much out of what they're buying because the amount that they're buying, $450 million a month, is about what they make in interest on their $3 trillion hoard, right? Depending on what interest they're getting. But it's pretty close to what they're making in interest a month. So they're replacing, so what they're basically doing is saying, okay, instead of allowing the interest to increase our reserves, we are now buying some gold. So we need to see actually a pickup from this level. We need to see them move from 10, 11 tons to 20 tons, and then we'll know that there is something going on. But that, I think they hold the key to the market. They hold the key to this market. Otherwise, the market is well-balanced. Supplies are flattening. Production is going to a steep decline for the next few years. There's been very little worthwhile exploration. Whatever exploration we have done and found gold, it's taken forever to get it out of the ground for many reasons. A lot of it has to do with regulation and nationalistic pressures in different governments where they try to take more of the resource for themselves. So production is it's going down quickly. By the way, if you take a case like South Africa, which at one time used to produce, I think it was 1,000 tons a year of gold, and now they produce less than 200 tons a year. So it's really coming down. One of their mines has closed recently. It went down 3 miles. That's how far down they had to go to find gold. So gold is in South Africa. So gold is difficult metal to find and to extract. And so the supply side is steady to shrinking. The demand side now is waiting for China to wake up. You know, China wake up and see whether you want to increase your gold reserves. That should be the key to this market in the next few years.
Let's turn to Greece. Greece is one of the major themes in the portfolio. It's rallied a lot off its lows, but then again, it declined. Its decline to those lows seemed a bit off the wall. Is the recovery in Greek bank shares just a more rational response to conditions and the decline an irrational response, or is this the beginning of something that is what we've been waiting for quite a while now?
I got to tell you that if I could, I would have 100% allocation of the portfolio in Greek banks. I think it's just close or as near as I can think of a sure thing. Nothing is sure in life, but as near as I can of a sure thing. But we can't. And the reason we can't is because liquidity is extremely, extremely low. And, you know, you want to sell $10 million worth of shares and you probably move the stock 3%. You know, so it is difficult to take a large position. Nevertheless, we still have about a 12% exposure to it, which, given its volatility and its liquidity, its illiquidity, it's a large position. It is come off the lows. The lows were reached a few months ago. It's come off the lows by 50%, but everything is now moving in the right direction. The economy is improving. The economy is the fastest growing European economy in the Eurozone, the fastest growing economy in the Eurozone after many, many years of the depression. Unemployment has come down from 25% to 15%. The brain drain has halted. The banks have managed now to cut some of their provisions, their very large provisions. They're cutting back some provisions, and there is now movement There will be some deal made with the government where they will be able to improve the quality of those assets. They will allow people to renegotiate their loans and they'll be available for them some help from the government. So I believe that the quality of their portfolio will improve significantly in the next year, so that it will have a tremendous leveraging effect on their balance sheets. And on top of all this, we have elections coming either sometime between May and October, possibly May, but it's more likely to be in October. But whatever the case is, the opposition party, which is much more business friendly, is well ahead in the polls and likely to win. So that's going to be very favorable for them too. So I believe that it's a very, very bright future for those banks. They're still selling somewhere around 30 cents a book. Their European counterparts are selling closer to 75 cents a book. So there is a lot of upside here. We think that 200-300% upside from here. So that's a significant position, and that could be that we remain very bullish there.
Okay, you have four major themes in the global macro fund: short the Australian banks, long the Greek banks, long home builders, and long gold in the asset allocation fund. You don't have the Australian banks. You have a long position in internet security stocks, but the portfolio and a long position in bonds, which in a way reflects a kind of bearish view that's taken up by the short position in Australian banks in the global macro fund. But this is a fairly concentrated portfolio. However, you have also some idiosyncratic trades that are orbiting these major themes. And one of those, let's talk about those. But before we do, please, in the interest of time, let's not get so wound up about Tesla that we go on and on. So we know that Tesla is one of them. It's, you know, it's a hot button for everybody. But could you talk a little bit about those satellite positions?
Right. So this position was originally taken, maybe 6 months ago. So we started taking this position about six months ago, and it was a sort of, we called it a package of companies that had a credit rating, let's say, of triple B, but that their triple B rating, it was closer to a double B or less, but that for some reason they haven't been yet, their rating hasn't been dropped yet, but it was inevitable that it would happen. And so we thought to ourselves that maybe what we should do is, instead of selling their debt, which has a fairly high yield, we can sell the equity, and the equity is likely to suffer first and most before debt. So that would be a better way of playing that potential credit development, the downgrade development.
Right.
It turns out, I mean, we did it with maybe something like 12 stocks. But we decided that what we will do is we'll watch each one individually, and as they perform better or did something to alleviate their debt burdens, we would get out of them. So it was even though it was a package, but it was looked at it individually. I you know what, if you asked me today, would I do it today? I wouldn't do it today. And the reason I wouldn't do it today is because it's very hard for us to tell when that business cycle will turn. This is predicated on the fact that business cycle would stall or turn, the economy would stall or turn, and these companies would be in great trouble. But that predication is in doubt. We really can't.
It's a timing issue.
It's a timing issue. So we have allowed the position to be reduced. We have cut back, and then maybe we're down to maybe six or seven stocks. It is small in the total portfolio. One of them that was added was Tesla, which was a perennial short position in our portfolio, but we added it to that group, so it was easier for us to sort of categorize it. And it is unusual for us to do that because we don't we don't feel we have an expertise in individual stocks, and try to shy away from that, and normally consider this as a package. But Tesla cannot be considered part of a package. Tesla is sui generis.
Sui generis. Sui generis.
Yeah, totally. And so it's outside and it's inside. It has a lot of debt. It has. It only made money, I think, one quarter, and I'm not sure if one looks closely whether that was a profit, and it's starting to run into some very serious problems. One of them is that the demand for their cars is, as we saw last quarter, is now stalled, and it's lower than their estimate. So they have ramped up production a bit with all kinds of production problems we have heard. But the demand now has fallen, and they lose money in every car, and the subsidy that kept them alive for so long, $7,500 per car, is cut back now to half, and it will be cut back again to nothing soon, in a few months, because it's dependent on the volume of cars being sold. So whatever was propping them up is disappearing. And on top of that, you have a lot of competition now coming into the market. It took a while for the major companies to gear up and produce electric cars. I'm not sure they'll be happy. I'm not sure anybody will be happy producing these electric cars because they're not profitable. But we will have big companies like BMW and Audi and so on all making electric cars. And they're all coming into the market, so the competition will start being very fierce and very difficult for them. Their business plans are a mess because they change their minds now every few weeks. They're closing their sales room and they're only doing it through the internet, and then they're opening some and then they're keeping some open, and then they're changing the prices on the internet. So there is a lot of disarray in the company, a lot of key people have left in the past few months. So we think that the company, personally, I think the company will go broke. I thought the company would have gone broke already in 2018. So our options at that time, our put options expire worthless or with very little money. But I do think that they're going broke. And so we decided instead of doing it via put options, we actually went short outright. And it's interesting because only now can you short outright without a big penalty. Last year was very difficult to short because everybody had bought shares and it was difficult to find shares to sell, and you were paying very high interest rates to carry the short position. Today it's easy to do, which means that the market is not anymore that bearish, and that for us is a good sign. So we think that it will slip away. It will break 250 or 245, and then it will go down very quickly after that. And so we do have a small short position, which I hope to maybe increase as it breaks lower levels. And the other ones, yeah, what's that?
How big? I think there are many people willing to know.
I believe it's somewhere between 2.5% and 3% of the portfolio. Okay. And, you know, maybe I expect it to go up to 5 to 8 at some point, but you know, we'll see how it does.
Okay. And the others, did you want to talk about the other ones?
And the other ones are, again, it's a potpourri of stocks. It's about 6 or 7 stocks, and we're watching them closely. Chances are that if any of them makes a move to improve from a credit point of view, Eastman Chemical, Kellogg, Textron, Weyerhaeuser, if they make moves to improve their credit position or their stocks begin to behave better, we will be getting out of them. So it's not a major position, and it's one that, frankly, today I would not put on, but the position is on, and it's some of them are doing what we think they should be doing, so we keep them. But it's I believe that the total exposure today to that position is something like 13% of the portfolio and decreasing.
Okay, thank you. Al, in the interest of time, we said that we'd be finished at 10:30. We're a little bit 5 minutes over. Before I let you go, I want to just address one issue that I should have addressed at the beginning of the call, and that is that a number of clients have written back to me asking who is Jamie McCrae, and it never dawned upon me that this would be a bit of an issue. But Jamie signed the quarterly report, and I think it's a good opportunity for you to introduce Jamie and to tell listeners and investors exactly what he does and what he doesn't do.
Right, right. So he does a lot of things. He's in our trading desk, and he's very helpful in analysis of trading, and that was how to execute. He's very good at in understanding execution. I guess he's good in a lot of things. I'm not going to try to go into the different areas, but he writes well, he understands well our strategies, and I thought that would give him a way for him to express that in a very short form, and it would relieve me of that pressure of having to write and go into a lot of thinking behind it. So the idea was more to express it in a short way and just factually, and then to be able to discuss it at this kind of forum more at length. I think he did a great job, and I think that that's a good formula for us, because it can expedite our quarterly reports, and it can make them meaningful, even though they're sometimes shorter, and they are shorter, but they're quite meaningful. Together with the conference calls, I think that they will give the client a good picture of what we're doing.
So to be clear, Jamie helped you author the quarterly report. He sits on the execution desk. He's a member. He's my colleague in the risk management committee. But I think one of the things that clients want to know is that the risk decisions are still made entirely by you.
That's correct. Right.
Okay, Al. Well, thank you very much for the time. This concludes the call for today. If you guys have any questions, feel free to email me or get in touch with me via my cell. Once again, my phone number is 416-993-4160, or you can get in touch with your representative at Freeburg. Al, thanks again for the time. Wish you good luck for the coming quarter, and let's make some money.
Okay. Good, David. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too, Al. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.